Plugged In, I'm Greta Van Susteren, and today we look at the U.S. decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. We're live on Voice America's Facebook page, and we want your comments and questions for our guests. Now, Donald Trump campaigned for president, a promise to get out of the Iran nuclear deal. And for the first 15 months of his term in office, Mr. Trump grudgingly stayed in the deal, while continuing, though, to denounce it. Well, now the president has kept his campaign promise, reimposing economic sanctions that effectively ends U.S. participation in the multinational deal. We begin our coverage of VOA's Bill Gallo on President Trump's action and the global reaction.
Blasting what he called its glaring flaws, Donald Trump announced the U.S. will leave the Iran nuclear agreement.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Trump is immediately reimposing Iran sanctions, which had been lifted as part of the 2015 agreement.
Today's action sends a critical message. The United States no longer makes empty threats. When I make promises, I keep them.
In Iran, President Hassan Rouhani said he's open to staying in the deal, but warned Tehran could begin enriching uranium if the talks fail.
I ordered
the Iranian Atomic Energy Organization to be ready for action if needed, so that, if necessary, we can begin our industrial enrichment without any limitations.
America's closest allies had mounted a last-minute effort to convince Trump to stay in the deal. Britain's foreign secretary went so far as to appear on Trump's favorite cable news show, Fox and Friends.
But you've got to do that without just throwing the baby out with the bathwater, without scrapping the whole thing. Because if you do that, you have to answer the question, what next?
The Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2015 between Iran, the U.S., Britain, France, China, Russia, and Germany. Trump complained that the deal allowed Iran to resume some nuclear activities after 10 years. He didn't like that the accord didn't address Iran's support for militant groups, and he was upset it didn't restrict Iran's ballistic missile program.
We just can't let the political leadership of an important Middle Eastern country do what the Ayatollah is doing. It's wrong, it's immoral, it's not good for the Iranian people, it's not good for the world, and we've asked him to stop. And diplomacy hasn't worked. And, you know, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do.
Without the U.S., it's unclear how long the deal will last. Some say not long.
This may not result in the collapse of the deal immediately. It probably won't. But eventually, it will lead to the collapse. Iran will eventually decide to withdraw.
And to some critics, that makes it more likely than ever that Iran eventually gets a nuclear weapon.
You know, when you sign an agreement and within 2 years you change governments, the next government reneges on the agreement, it's sure to make other countries that might enter into big agreements with you, particularly countries like the North Koreans that are most analogous to the Iranians of anybody else we're dealing with, think twice.
Trump said he is interested in negotiating a new deal with Iran. However, he said the same thing after pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Deal. So far, there's been no apparent success at those renegotiations. Bill Gallo.
Ernest Moniz is a renowned nuclear physicist. When he was energy secretary in the Obama administration, Moniz was one of the U.S. negotiators of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now, that's the official name of the Iran nuclear agreement. I talked to him last week about the criticism of the agreement and asked how soon Iran could develop a nuclear weapon if President Trump decided to withdraw from the deal, which the president, of course, has now done.
Well, first of all, the agreement is structured so that for a minimum of 10 years, Iran would require at least 1 year to assemble the nuclear material for one bomb. But that assumes that they do everything out in the open, in public. In reality, I don't think Iran or any other country is going to start doing things in the open in moving towards a nuclear weapon. By far, the biggest threat is what happens in the shadows. And that's what the Iran agreement, uniquely for any country in the world, provides the opportunity to go anywhere where there is reason to suspect possible activity violating the JCPOA. That includes military sites. And to do it within a window of time of 24 days max. No other country has that.
So in 24 days, if you tried to clean up in 24 days and cover your tracks, if you're developing a nuclear weapon, would that be impossible?
So we feel very confident, as we've said, and frankly it's based upon some classified experimentation done at our national laboratories, that certainly work, which you would have to do, involving uranium and plutonium, you would not be able to clean up in that time period.
How much would you need, to think?
I'm not going to get into how much time, but let's just say it's not a simple task given modern capabilities to detect microscopic particles.
Well, could you say that it wouldn't be like 30 days? I mean, that it's significantly more than two.
No, it would be, if we're confident for 24 days, you can assume it's not 25 days.
Okay. Would you offer this deal to North Korea?
Well, actually, I wrote something on this not too long ago, saying that as the president enters into discussions with the North Korean leader, he needs to focus on verification. Frankly, given the fact that they have nuclear weapons already, in contrast to Iran, that they did so even as they nominally had other agreements, I think, if anything, the ante is raised with respect to Iran. What I wrote back in March was that President Reagan always emphasized trust but verify when he was negotiating nuclear agreements with the Soviet Union in the 80s. But for Iran and North Korea, our North Star was and must be don't trust and verify, verify, verify. If there is no very, very strong, intrusive verification regime with North Korea, I don't see why we would bother to enter into a detailed negotiation.
With respect to North Korea has a nuclear weapon, Iran didn't, and that's not an insignificant difference. But how would you compare and contrast the two Iran and North Korea situations?
Well, again, having a nuclear weapon in North Korea does, in my view, require a negotiation that is broader than just nuclear weapons. It's about the whole security context in the region. And, of course, recently the North Korean leader has made some statements that are interesting in that dimension, but the proof will be in the pudding in terms of a detailed agreement. With Iran, it's a situation where, obviously, we have enormous problems with their regional activities from Lebanon and Hezbollah and Syria, the Iraq and Yemen, human rights violations, missile violations. But the main goal of JCPOA was make sure the nuclear weapon option is verifiably off the table. And then we continue to operate and to increase the pressure on these other things. So it's quite different. There will be some parallels, such as just as the Iran agreement was a multilateral negotiation led by the United States in terms of face-to-face negotiations, the North Korea situation will also have to be multilateral because, obviously, China's interests, South Korea's interests, our interests, Japan's interests, and probably Russia's interests will all have to be accommodated. So there are some parallels, but major differences, I think, in terms of the scope required. But again, a parallel, go back to that, verification, verification, verification. And another difference is, frankly, the Iranian society is much more open than the North Korean. And we cannot repeat the failed verification regimes of the past where inspectors were allowed to go only where North Korea said they could go. We need to have the same thing we now have in Iran, the ability to go anywhere where there is a suspect activity.
Is it an unfair criticism of the Iran deal, nuclear deal, the JCPOA, that it is a stall on Iran achieving a nuclear weapon status, that it just puts it off for a period of 10 years or so? Is that an unfair criticism?
Absolutely. It is incorrect. And the reason is, first of all, I should say that there are restrictions on their nuclear activity for 15 years, but much more important than that. When those statements are made, and the president repeated that statement just recently in a tweet,
president.
The current president, President Trump, it is suggesting that somehow when these nuclear activity restrictions are finished, which is 15 years, that somehow we're back to where we were and Iran races to a nuclear weapon. That's incorrect. The verification regime did not exist before the Iran agreement. And as I've said, the verification regime, the toughest in the world that the world has ever seen, wasn't there. We had no meaningful verification regime. Now we have it. We have it forever. And that is key, again, to being able to certainly raise the bar very, very high in terms of intelligence services pointing towards possible suspect activity. In fact, once again, I would say the Prime Minister Netanyahu's announcement kind of demonstrates the power of the various national means that we have, whether it's Israel, the United States, or other of our friends and allies. We have lots of ability to see in to what's going on. The JCPOA, with its unprecedented access, the IAEA, the international inspectors, they are looking at incredible amounts of imagery, of et cetera. They are able, because of the JCPOA, to use all the modern technologies of surveillance.
So what are the next steps for the United States, for U.S. allies and adversaries who signed the agreement, and what's next for Iran? Joining us, James Dobbins, senior fellow at the RAND Corporation. He is a former assistant secretary of state, having served presidents of both political parties. He believes the U.S. should have stayed in the Iran nuclear agreement. Ilan Berman is senior vice president of the American Foreign Policy Council. He has consulted for the CIA and Department of Defense. Ilan has been critical of the Iran nuclear deal, but believes it's a problem pulling out without an alternative plan. And Brett Decker is a former senior vice president at the Export-Import Bank of the U.S. and co-author of the book, The Conservative Case for Trump. He supports the president's decision to pull out of the Iran deal with Iran. Welcome to all of you gentlemen. First to you, Jim. The IAEA says that Iran is in compliance with the nuclear portion of the agreement. But what about the point, was the president correct in saying that the money that has been given, returned, unfrozen for Iran, that that has been used to spread more terrorism in Yemen and Syria by the Iranians?
I don't think there's any way we know that the money, that actual money was spent in that manner. The money went into their budget. They continued to do those activities. And therefore, you can argue that since money is fungible, it helped. It was their money. It had been frozen by the United States for several decades. And under the agreement, we agreed to give it back.
Did you think that was a good idea?
I think in the context of the overall deal, it was worth doing.
Now to you, Ilan. You didn't like the deal in the beginning, but if I'm correct, but now your view is that having done the deal, you don't know where we're going now.
No, so to sort of correct the record a little bit, I think I was very skeptical of the deal from the outset for a very simple reason, because the deal is tactical in the sense that it deals with only one aspect of Iran's regional behavior and international
doesn't do missiles, doesn't do questions about terrorism.
But the gains that Iran has received as a result of the deal, and this is sort of really where I come down, are dangerous because the gains are strategic. This amount of money that we're talking about, the $100+ billion in previously escrowed oil revenue, as well as the direct, several billion dollars in direct aid that was provided from the Obama administration to Iran. Right? This is sort of the stories about pallets of cash and all that. That has really set Iran on a path of regional expansion in a way that I believe was unforeseen by the Obama administration, but it is a state of affairs that needs to be rolled back now.
Which is sort of interesting because there have been protests, at least in the past several months, and I guess continue today with some of the rural areas of Iran, where they're unhappy that they didn't get any of the benefit, so they say, so they protest of the unfrozen assets, the money, and that the suspicion is that it's going out to help Hezbollah, help the fighting, and help Iran's position in Yemen.
No, that's exactly right. And look, I think the enormous gamble that the Obama administration made was that this deal would lead to a substantial beneficial behavior change in Iran. But it hasn't. What we've seen in the almost 3 years since the passage of the JCPOA in July of 2015 has been that Iran, like it has throughout its almost 40-year history, the Islamic Republic, has consistently preferred guns over butter. And so the money that they have received as a result and the political normalization they've received as a result of the deal has enabled this landmark Iranian expansion throughout the region, into Syria, in places like Yemen. And that's really sort of the undergirding, enabling element that the deal has created.
All right, Brett, but the expansion took place well before the deal. I mean, there hasn't been any significant change in Russia, in Iranian presence in Syria, for instance, since the deal.
Well, I don't think it's actually correct, because if you look at the what the U.S. intelligence community estimates in terms of the numbers of Iranian-supported irregulars, Pakistani, Yemeni, Iraqi Shia that are now operating in the Syrian theater, that have been brought there by the IRGC, you can make a pretty reasonable case that that simply wouldn't have been possible without the resources and the freedom of movement that was enabled by the deal.
Brett, and it certainly didn't improve their behavior, right, at all.
That's fair. So.
Brett, looking at our relationship now with our allies, we've got the UK, Germany, and France who disagreed with President Trump on this, but everyone is still saying that, you know, we're all still friends, we're all still allies. So what's sort of the greater impact? Because we have the sanctions being lifted, they're still going to have their deals with Iran, and then we may take action against them if their banks are doing deals with Iran.
Yeah, it's a really important factor, and I think if you look at the history of how this has worked out in the past, everyone always cries and screams, but then they usually follow what the U.S. does. So in 2011, when we instituted sanctions last time, you had almost exactly the same thing playing out. People saying the sanctions regime wouldn't work, it'd be embarrassing for the U.S., it'd be a failure, and then everybody kind of end up following the U.S.'s lead. So I think that's what you're going to see happen again. And a larger reason is, all these people, all the business they do, the trade do, a lot of it is in dollar-denominated business. So at the end of the day, do they choose an economy that's less than $400 billion over a $19 trillion economy? And I think they stick with us when it comes down to it.
I think that may be accurate, but it's not accurate to say that this is the way it's always worked in the past. When the Europeans and other major countries agree in general with our objective, they go along with our sanctions even if they're unilateral. When they disagree with our objective, they push back. This happened in the early 1980s when Reagan tried to sanction companies that were building a pipeline between the Soviet Union and Russia. The Europeans pushed back, threatened to retaliate against U.S. companies, and Reagan pulled back. In the 1990s, Congress passed the Helms-Burton Act that penalized European companies investing in Cuba. The Europeans took us to the World Trade Organization and threatened retaliatory action against U.S. companies, and Clinton pulled back. So doing this when you're going with the tide, everybody agrees with you, you know, then they say, okay, we don't like these extraterritorial sanctions, but we'll live with them. But when you're going against the tide, there are historic examples where they've pushed back successfully.
I just think the stakes are so high and the differences of the size of the economy that it's just not worth it to
Cuba
business
wasn't even
with
the
U.S. over business
and
with Iran.
I actually think there's another factor as well, it's not just sufficient to talk about the reimposition of sanctions. It's actually important to look at what sanctions have been reimposed. One of the most important measures that the president signed concurrent with his announcement yesterday was a reimposition of sanctions on financial transactions having to do with the Iranian Central Bank. And this is a huge deal, and it's a huge deal because it puts companies and countries that do business with Iran in front of a choice. They may not like that choice, but it puts them in front of a choice. You can either do business with the Iranian economy, but if you do, you will systematically get shut out of
which is what I think France, Germany, and the UK are really focusing on. I mean, look at just France has that huge Airbus contract with Iran. And I mean, that's $20 billion, I think, is one report of it. It's a huge number. But what's going to be the impact on the Iranian people? I mean, we know how it's going to probably affect the other parts of the world, but how are the Iranian people going to feel day to day on this?
So I think the answer has to do almost entirely with what the Iranian regime does in response here. The Iranian regime is now at this sort of inflection point with regard to what it can do. It can do what the Iranian president and supreme leader have threatened to do, which is to walk away from the deal themselves, to restart industrial-grade uranium enrichment, to really sort of sprint out of the gate. And come out of the confines of the JCPOA. But they know, I think, all the bluster aside, they know that doing that will turn the court of international public opinion against them. It will actually make the case for President Trump in front of French President Emmanuel Macron, in front of German Chancellor Angela Merkel, that actually Iran is doing precisely what we were afraid they were going to do. So I think what you're going to see is a lot of bluster out of Iran, but the Iranians, for both international but also for domestic reasons, because they are sitting on top of society in ferment, will be much more circumspect about what they do.
One of the questions I posed to the former Secretary of Energy is whether or not, you know, this was just a delaying tactic in terms of this agreement, whether it just meant that Iran wouldn't have a nuclear weapon for so many years. Do you believe, I asked both of you on this to say, do you believe that the agreement, the original agreement, would have prevented Iran from ever gaining a nuclear weapon?
I don't think so at all. I think it was one at sunset in 2025 anyway, so at most it was a delaying tactic. But with all the weaknesses of it, especially on verification of sites and all that, there's no guarantee other than taking their word for it that they were doing what they were going to say they were going to do. So at best, I think it was just delaying.
Jim?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't think there is any weakness in terms of the verification program. It's very clear. We can go to any site that we have suspicion
about. But what happens post-sunset?
And as Motin said, no, the sunset for several provisions of it, including enrichment, for instance. Other provisions like forbidding nuclear weapons and maintaining the verification regime are permanent. They never lapse, except they've now lapsed as a result of the U.S. decision, potentially. But they never lapse. And the verification provision allows the IAEA to go anywhere in Iran. Now, the Iranians have kept saying that they won't allow them on certain sensitive military sites, but the IAEA has never asked to go to a sensitive military site. We've never asked
them
to go.
Why
haven't they? They haven't because we've never given them a reason to think that there is suspicious activity there.
But wouldn't you think that would be sort of prudent to do? I mean, if you're going to do thorough inspections, wouldn't you think that that would be, you know, a particular place to go to?
Let's be cynical. We may not have asked because we thought the Iranians would ultimately agree and we'd undercut one of our talking points against the agreement.
And what's the optimistic? What's the optimistic view? Flip side to the cynical.
I mean, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't try to extend many of the provisions that lapse. I'm just saying we've got 5 or 6 years to do that in. And as they begin to lapse, a new negotiation extending them in exchange, obviously, for further concessions on our side is perfectly reasonable.
Let me switch to the other side of the world, North Korea. Very different situation. They actually have a nuclear weapon. They have a delivery system, a missile. I don't know if they've been able to marry the two together. How would you approach the North Korea discussion?
You know, I think the president right now has done a great job, and you know, you have bizarre people crediting him sort of in moments of weakness, but he did something that no president ever has done before, and he linked trade with China with peace in North Korea. And if you want anything to happen in North Korea, China has to get involved. And President Trump made China motivated. And I think that's what he's going to keep doing. You know, as long as China is engaged, you know, they can kind of pull the strings in Pyongyang a little bit. And I think that was kind of the genius of Trump's move. It's a tough play, but I think it's working.
I think there's a second line of inquiry here also. And as we heard from many sources, including some of the material that you had in your upfronts, there are people who say that getting out of the JCPOA really undercuts the case for North Korea to be motivated to make a deal with the United States. And we sort of need to unpack that a little bit. First of all, the JCPOA was not a treaty. It was an executive agreement. And the reason it was an executive agreement formulated in that way was because the Obama administration had trouble having it pass muster.
They couldn't get two-thirds to get under our Constitution to get a treaty. And, of course,
right.
had President Obama been able to get the treaty back
there
in 2015,
no
President Trump couldn't just write and sign a piece of paper and back out.
Correct. And so I think this is actually a moment of strategic messaging for the Trump administration. This was a deal that was unpopular in many quarters. There's a 2016 poll that was done by the Washington Post that showed that ordinary Americans opposed the JCPOA by a 2-to-1 margin. And so you can take that ammunition, intellectual ammunition, and go to North Korea and say the Iran deal was too weak to stand. And if you don't want the same to happen to whatever agreement you hammer out with us, you have to show us more. You have to be more transparent. You have to give us more. So my sense is this is something that Trump can use to his favor in negotiations with the North Koreans.
Jim, we haven't talked about Russia. Where's Russia and all the Iran stuff?
Let me say a little something on Korea first. There's an insuperable obstacle to a truly verifiable agreement with North Korea. North Korea has nuclear weapons. It has missiles. The infrastructure to build nuclear weapons is big, it's heavy, it's immobile, and it's observable from space in large amount. Nuclear weapons are small. You can put them in a room. You can hide them. And I don't think that any regime, even the regime for Iran, which is the most extensive verification regime in the history of arms control, would be satisfactory in terms of actually assuring us that Kim Jong-un has given up every single one of his nuclear weapons.
All right. I'll get the Russia question to you then, Brett. We only have 90 seconds left. What do you think Russia is thinking as we pull out of Iran?
I mean, I think Russia is probably looking at an opportunity, right? They want to drive a wedge between Europe and the United States, and I think they're going to just create a bunch of noise. But at the end of the day, I think Trump's in the driver's seat.
Jim, you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think Russia will see an opportunity. They'll side with the Europeans. They'll continue to try to keep the agreement in effect. And they'll be delighted if the U.S. and the Europeans don't compose their differences.
Gentlemen, thank you all very much. And before we go, an update on two journalists jailed for doing their job, Walone and Jaw So Oo. They're journalists in Myanmar, and they're working for Reuters. They were arrested last December while investigating the execution by police in Myanmar's Rakhine State of 10 Rohingya men and boys. The government says the journalists violated the Official Secrets Act. And 3 weeks ago, a police captain testified for the government that his boss, the police chief, had ordered him to entrap the journalists by giving them secret documents and then arresting them for having the secret documents. The government, apparently surprised by this testimony, then asked the judge to declare the police captain, the government's own witness, as unreliable. The judge denied that request. So what happened next? The police captain who testified that the journalists were framed is now himself in jail for violating Myanmar's Police Disciplinary Act. Meanwhile, the two Reuters reporters have been in jail for about 150 days, and we hope for their quick release. That's all the time we have for today. Stay plugged in by liking us on Facebook at Voice America. You can also like my Facebook page at facebook.com/Greta. And, of course, follow me on Twitter @Greta. Thank you for being plugged in.